All right. Any other questions about the packet? Or any other question? I think we're ready for our main attraction of the evening. I thought it would be great on this 10th anniversary to have somebody not only who has been here 10 years, but who was so excited about the first conference they brought their 4-month-old child who has been here all 10 years. And we appreciate that. But I would like at this time to call up Carrie Graves. Carrie, come forward.
Okay, I want to see if this is loud enough for everybody first. Okay?
Good.
Okay, great. I'm going to start my clock. I have to start by saying how amazing it is for me to be standing up here tonight and how honored I am to have the opportunity to testify to what the Hayden Institute, Bob Hayden's work, and the work of all his wonderful colleagues has meant to me. Joyce, Larry, Chelsea, Jeremy, Diana, and Doug, Kathy, and Heidi Darhope, Susan Sims-Smith, and Agnes Parker, who I don't think are here tonight. You have all been instrumental in helping me find my life, and I'm glad to have tonight to thank you. I want to share with you my experience of 9 years of the Hayden Institute's Canoga Summer Dream Conference through dreams and memories. I find it very appropriate that we begin today on Pentecost. 2,000 years ago, when the church is reputed to have had its birth, people who spoke different tongues suddenly understood each other through the power of the Holy Spirit. We are here this week to listen to the Holy Spirit, who is speaking to us below the level of conscious language and God's language of metaphor and archetype, a place where we can all understand each other and seek unity. The first dream I can remember having, I was somewhere around preschool age, is one that's going to make my mother, who's been with me at this conference every year but one, and who is here tonight, cringe. In the dream, I am in a parking lot, a grocery store parking lot, and that grocery store has a big yellow rubber ducky on top. Do any of you remember Bilo in the 1970s? It used to have a cow on top. I think that's where that came from. And I have to tell you, in the dream, my mother left me at that grocery store. Left me. A kid's worst nightmare. As you might be suspecting by now, a core theme in my life, and that of most nines on the Enneagram, of which I am one, is fear of separation, fear of loss of all connection, of loss of holy love. Despite the fact that I had seen a cow grocery store in the waking world, but never a ducky one, I truly couldn't distinguish between the dream world and waking life on this one. I really thought my mother had left me there. I even told my brother so some months later. It was so real, I can still see it like I dreamed it last night. My toddlerish self looking up at my mother from the parking lot, her navy blue and white do-rag and big sunglasses backlit by the hazy sky. I was a little angry, I guess, that she'd left me, although the fact that she was standing there for me to look at must have meant she'd at least come back for me, right? And what I've realized in looking back is that, archetypally, if she was going to leave me somewhere, what better place than a grocery store? A place filled with food, nourishment, and all the ingredients I could need to create and transform into a fulfilling meal. But the ducky on top, this one has stumped me in years past. I don't remember a personal association with these cheerful toys other than Ernie from Sesame Street singing about his best friend Rubber Ducky. So I'll go collective. A rubber ducky is a cute, perky, waterproof toy for children. It can float in water, likes bubbles, and symbolizes the sweetness of childhood. It seems to represent new life, an ever-present totem at baby showers and in babies' rooms. Eventually, when I was about 6 years old, I got over my insistence that I'd been abandoned by my mother and went about my life. always nagged in the back of my mind by the fear of loss of connection. So, like a proper nine, I worked my way through day by day, seeing all sides of situations and merging with as many perspectives as I could. Anything to feel connected, to feel a part of something and not like an exile on the island of misfit toys. These coping mechanisms got me by for a while, for about 30 years. But when I was 31, it happened again. This time in my waking life. And this time, it was God who left me at the grocery store. God, who up until this time had ever been present, like when my cat was hit by a car on Palm Sunday. God, who I begged daily to protect those that I loved. God, who I knew would somehow make things work out for me since I couldn't and wouldn't believe in myself. God, who helped me find work that I loved and a husband I loved, despite my fear of losing my parents, friends, or anyone who loved me. I stood, stunned in that parking lot, unable to see. It was bleak and empty, no cars in sight. I went to church one Sunday, and for the first time in my life, I felt nothing. The lights went out. It had finally happened. My childhood nightmare had become my waking truth. I was alone. This journey began in early 2003. I had been pursuing for several months a medical solution to a sleep condition Mom and I share. My deep sleep seems to be often interrupted by bursts of near awakening, and as a result, I dreamed and still do dream vividly all night long, creating science fiction movies or acting in long TV-like dramas filled with characters from my life. And I wake up tired every day, sometimes feeling worse than when I went to sleep. My vivid, almost never pleasant dreams took me to my nightly torture chamber again and again, and half of my exhaustion upon waking seemed to be emotional from the trauma. Naturally, my days were then filled with periods of serious sleepiness and a desire to lie down. Those of you that know me well know I can't get through an afternoon workshop or an evening session without a cup of coffee. So, after a sleep study and my trying a rainbow of prescriptions, the FDA finally approved Rohypnol, the date rape drug, for use in treating sleep disorders and their resulting symptoms. I didn't really have any of the symptoms this drug was supposed to be targeting, but my doctor wanted to try it, and I suppose I did too, if it would help. It did not help. In fact, I felt it made me not dream. I would wake up feeling like I'd been staring at the walls of a surgical ward, blank, empty, without color or fear, annoyance or action. It was really, really strange. And as blissful as that felt for a minute, I also knew it felt profoundly wrong. Jeremy Taylor will tell you that science has proven that any creature that remotely has the suggestion of an eyelid has rapid eye movement while sleeping. We're supposed to dream. It's as necessary and life-giving as breathing, even if we don't remember our dreams. Because this liquid drug couldn't be taken with food, as it would all go out the other end with the food and not into the bloodstream, I had two strategies. One, I skipped dinner so I could go to bed at a reasonable time. Or two, I ate and then stayed up really late waiting for the food to digest enough for me to take the drug effectively. This didn't work out so well either. I lost a whole bunch of weight, became significantly depressed, and eventually got to the point where I could barely function. I went to work. I went to church. I was in a spiritual crisis, a dark night of the soul. I'm really glad I didn't know Joyce yet, that I hadn't heard her say you're in the pit for 7 years. I think the thought of 7 more years of this would have been so depressing, I wouldn't have attempted to crawl out. But like my mother's presence in the parking lot, God came back for me. When I realized I could see the ribs under my collarbone, like you see on someone nearly starving, I was shocked into feeling something, fear. And I knew this wouldn't do. I was killing myself. I quit the date rape drug, stayed home from work for a few days, and for the first and only time in my life, purposefully attempted to get fat. I also listened to Carolyn Mace's Energy Anatomy CDs, which had been on my bookshelf for 6 months waiting for me, loaned by a friend who always seemed to be there as a spiritual guide. And I read Enneagram books. I began to feel the first tugs of Jesus calling Lazarus back from the grave. My dry bones began to twitch. From Carolyn Mace's work, I learned about spiritual crisis and diagnosed myself. I began to learn about the root causes of our physical tragedies, the spiritual infirmities that manifest themselves in the material world. I started to see myself clearly for the first time through the Enneagram, the ancient Sufi personality system. My mother had long been interested in it, and I already knew I was a 9, so I dove right in to get the cold, hard truth. In April, the same angel that had loaned me the Energy Anatomy CDs felt that I needed to see a brochure she'd received for the first ever Canuga Summer Dream Conference, and which she sent via Heidi Darhope to the bookstore my husband and I owned. It appeared on my desk, a gift of grace. As I looked it over, I remembered poo-pooing not long before the suggestion from a fellow bookseller that I should have a dream journal. I mean, really, did she not know what kind of endless, purposeless garbage filled my nights? But by this point, when I'd been to the world of the opposite extreme, not dreaming, and no life in me to speak of, and the spark of spiritual transformation having been triggered in me, I was dying to go to the Canuga Summer Dream Conference. I loved Canuga, after all, and I needed some answers. I called my mom and told her about the conference. I don't remember how I described it to her or any other details. I only remember clearly hearing her say from her end of the phone in the North Carolina mountains, "Well, if you think it's the thing to do, we'll go." I said I did think it was the thing to do. God had left me all right in the parking lot of a grocery store, and this grocery store had Bob Hayden on top. I like to think of it as the Hayden Grocery. And really, if God had to leave me, what better place than an institution filled with food, nourishment, and all the ingredients I could need to create and transform into a fulfilling life? For me, this summer dream conference has carried me safely across the bridge from the innocence of childhood into a space of spiritual maturity and responsibility, where God is with me and I can never be abandoned. To come to this conference is a significant commitment of time and money, but one worth every penny. I use my vacation every year to be here. This is the priority. And so in 2003, Mom and I came on faith to the Canuga Summer Dream Conference. We came to learn about dreams. We didn't know the first thing about dreams, except that we both had too many every night and that really annoyed us. We arrived, and having nowhere to go since we were commuting from Asheville that year, we went to the Fireplace Lounge, a happy, familiar place reminiscent of Canuga Parish weekends past with our church in Columbia. We sat there awaiting our fate. We had no idea what we were exposing ourselves to. We looked at the schedule and saw many things that pointed to the sacred feminine and that looked quite interesting. Mom was afraid we might have landed ourselves in some sort of feminist camp. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But I told her, no, I didn't think so. I said, it's not going to be like that. It's more like, you know, the Da Vinci Code. Thank goodness that wild soap opera of a novel had come and cracked the door to the world of popular culture open just enough to plant the tiniest seed of the idea that something like the sacred feminine could be part of our Western American worldview. This conference, far from a weird, scary affair, is a doorway leading to the breath of life that will save the world. It has helped to save my faith and my life by equipping me with the ingredients I need to create a faithful life. It is a family reunion, a strong community of people who care about the welfare of the planet and every life in it. It is a bountiful grocery store filled with rich resources for doing inner work that allow us to discover the meaning of our lives to discover who it is God created each of us to be. I now know, thanks to this conference, that there is hope for the world and that we can help, that we must do our part by learning how to and doing our own inner work. As Jeremy said in the second or third year, he was raised by political protesters and became one himself. But he no longer believes that protest and rebellion are the way to make a difference. He said that the only way to transform the world and make a difference is by each of us doing our inner work in order that we might bring less darkness into the world. Wow. That sounds to me like a collect from the Book of Common Prayer, one created after centuries of humankind's trying to figure out its role in the salvation of the world. I believe that too, Jeremy, and it has given me meaning and purpose. That same year, in September of 2003, I began as a first-year student in a correspondence theology course from the School of Theology at Sewanee called Education for Ministry. I am a lifelong Episcopalian, someone who's always loved the church, and that year, after God left me at the Hayden grocery store, he led me to EFM. In this four-year course, done in small groups and churches, students study the Old Testament, New Testament, church history, theology, philosophy, and global and ethical issues. They also learn to see God acting in their lives through the process of theological reflection, a method not at all unlike dream work. These combined paths of gaining knowledge and wisdom, of academic experience on one hand, and gnosis, experience of faith through learning God's forgotten language of metaphor, on the other, these two things gave me new life. I don't like to use the phrase born again, but that's exactly how I felt that year. I had been born out of the rubber ducky stage and into the beginning of the adult stage of my spiritual life. Through the Hayden Summer Dream Conference, I have learned deep meanings of Scripture. I have learned how to be creative, how to accept myself and what is going on inside as well as outside of me. I have learned to see the world through the lens of God's love. I have been given the invaluable tool of using psychological language through which I can express myself, my faith, to myself and others. Here at the Summer Dream Conference, to quote Susan Sim Smith, we use a little bit of Jung to get to Jesus. This work has changed the way my brain is wired, and I am now connected to the right side of my brain, the metaphorical side that knows wholeness, oneness, worthiness, and belonging. You have done this, Bob Hayden. You have provided the environment and community that revived me and has given my life meaning. Thank you. I can often hear Larry Mays' holy voice saying from a lecture at the 2009 conference, "I am the vine. You are the branches. Abide in me, and I in you. Abide in my love." To me, this is a reminder to return to inner work, to dedicate time to listening to God and for God's direction. For, as Larry described, Jesus was telling us that we cannot flourish if we are not directly tapped into the one source of life. I happen, because of my nineness and my tiredness caused by the sleep condition, to be pretty terrible at self-discipline. Things like, you know, writing down dreams, setting aside time for prayer, exercise, anything that requires consistency. Yet I have this ongoing deep desire to practically live in a monastery. I think it would give me the discipline I need to help God help me become the person I was created to be. I have learned again and again through this conference that dedication is what's required. Also, in every book about spirituality and a fulfilled life I've read, this is what's required. Heck, to make it simple, the Bible tells me so. Abide in me. Abide in my love. This is where, in a strange twist, my curse is my gift. I dream so much I never rest. I never rest, so I always want to rest, so I don't make time for prayer or writing down dreams, and if I do, I fall asleep. But the dreams give me the discipline I can't give myself. I don't have a choice but to receive the dreams. And not everyone remembers vivid dreams like this every night. What this conference has done for me is allow me to receive my gift as I try to grow up through it. Instead of waking up traumatized, I may be wiped out from a particularly intense dream, but I wake up curious, hopeful, wondering what God is trying to tell me. And even when I can't figure it out, I believe and trust that the dream is working inside me. How's that for a complete change in perspective? A great burden has been lifted from me and great hope given to me. Where it fails, and where I know when my belief is not solid, is when I don't do my part. One of my favorite themes in the Old Testament is what's called the deceit motif, trying to get for ourselves what God has already promised us. Listen to that again, it's powerful. Trying to get for ourselves what God has already promised us. Do you really believe that you will receive what God has already promised you? I know I don't most of the time. Jacob did this by attempting to steal Esau's birthright. Joseph's brothers did this by throwing him in the well. Instead of trusting in redemption, they took matters into their own hands and got rid of what they perceived to be their problem. But what man intends for ill, God can use for good. I love the Old Testament Joseph. He is one of my favorite characters in the Bible, and of course, one of the reasons he's my favorite is his proclivity for powerful dreams and his ability to listen to them and help bring about the redemption of his world. Well, I'm no Joseph, but I'd like to be. I'm a little more like Jacob, just not in a competitive way. I'm like Jacob mostly in my thoughts, in a scrambling, untrusting way, and I have just come out of a particularly Jacobian period in my life. Joyce, the 7-year pit period by my calculations ended 2 years ago. And I think I did get out. I really do. But once I got out, I thought I was on my own. I forgot to trust God as much as I should. I was confused about doing my part and what that meant. My big struggle in the past decade is twofold: attempting to grow up and attempting to be accomplished, to be the person I was created to be. Without this conference, the whole deal would have been over 10 years ago. As it stands now, I have a chance. I am on a journey. Yes, I would still have had that spiritual crisis and would have still, through God's stirring, began to come alive again. But without the tools for the journey, the directions for transformation I've received here, I don't know where I'd be. I wouldn't have sought out dream work. God brought it to me. As I mentioned, I am far from redeemed, but I am on my lifelong journey. In 2006, 3 years into this conference, and 3 years after the beginning of my spiritual crisis, I had the most archetypal dream I've ever had, a true dream of transformation. It involves a major reference to the Harry Potter series of children's books by J.K. Rowling. A little background information. I have dreamed about Harry Potter several times, and I believe this is because A, I love the series and the powerful theology and archetypal journeys embedded in it, and B, as a bookseller in the 90s and 2000s, the advent and subsequent popularity of this series of books is a phenomenon that happens maybe once a century, and I experienced the entire thing as a bookseller, start to finish. I'd like to share this one long dream with you if you'll bear with me. I hope, as in Dream Group, you may find something in it that speaks to you. This is the dream. A woman I know in Colombia is getting married. I am in a building that seems to be a foyer or narthex of the church where she will be married in a few hours. It seems that I am to be the helper of the bride, the maid of honor possibly, but I have no dress to wear. I wasn't expecting to be the maid of honor. A dress appears that is supposed to be a possibility. It is a heavy cotton piqué dress, striking me as Jackie Kennedy-style shift dress made in two pieces. The back is solid black, and the front is white, with an embroidered black cross under the left shoulder, like where you'd wear a name tag. Someone says, "It hasn't been worn in 40 or 50 years. The bride says it would be perfect, But the wedding is now, and I can see the velvety moldiness on the black back of the dress, so I say another time. This narthex or foyer appears to be part of the house where Mom and I live. It is all light wood. Excuse me. It is known to me that Voldemort, the embodiment of supreme evil in the Harry Potter series, is coming. The house is basically clean and free from clutter, but there are a few things lying around, including an inexpensive pair of rhinestone earrings like I once had in waking life. There is also a wall-mounted TV playing. Voldemort is coming. He is coming, and the consequences will be terrible. Yet I'm not very worried about our possessions like the TV and earrings. I casually put a few things over to the side in one room that I'm pretty sure he won't find or have time to get. But they're just staples, like toiletries. The rhinestone earrings are left lying around, though I think I'm looking for them. Mom doesn't seem worried. I ask her if she doesn't understand that Voldemort is coming, yet I'm still not worried about our possessions. The scene shifts. It's outside, a midnight blue scene, laid out like a video game might be. There is a very narrow, horizontal, bridge-like balance beam I am standing on sideways. In the distance ahead to the right is a castle. The balance beam I'm on is the only thing keeping me from the water that is like a giant moat. The water is deep blue. The entire sky and surrounding horizon are deep blue. Perpendicular to the balance beam, but not touching it, is a pathway of double green squares. I am facing this path as if to set out on it. At the end of the path is a rounded gate supporting an archway of greenery that extends in a wall on either side of the arch. Looking down the wall of greenery to the right, I see another archway many feet away and a little farther back. The greenery there is covered in drooping, yellowy-orange, bell-like flowers. I suddenly appear farther ahead in the game, and I'm about halfway down the green path. There is a cheap white plastic square ring with rounded corners suspended above me that it seems I have to pull down around me to proceed. I pull the ring down over me. I'm wearing a white dress all this time, even though it's someone else's wedding. The dress, at this point on the path, seems almost like a nightgown, an old-fashioned one like in Peter Pan. I get to the archway directly in front of me, about to walk through, and I look to my right. A lion is coming around a slight corner toward me from out of that other archway, the one with the drooping flowers. He looks worried and weary, like Aslan from the Chronicles of Narnia on the way to the altar to be slaughtered. Part of me thinks he is Aslan, and I am flabbergasted when he asks me for advice on how to get through the archway, as I was getting ready to go through. I tell him, "You must have courage." It's quite simple, really. It's the only way, it seems. He comes up the path toward me and goes through the archway. I now seem to be looking at the green squared pathway from a perspective somewhere out in the water from the right side. On my right, floating in the air, is a reddish-orange hardback book with enchanted tales written on the spine. On the other side of the path, floating in the air, is a sequential series of paperback children's books, the Magic Treehouse series. Their covers are facing me, overlapping each other so that they are at a diamond-shaped angle. There is a long line of them, most of the covers seeming to be sky-colored. I'm back at the start of the game, standing on the balance beam again. Suddenly a prince is beside me. It is my husband, Andy. His hair is lighter than in waking life, more blondish and definitely in a Prince Valiant style. He is wearing a light cream, almost white tunic and leggings, a very simple outfit for a prince. It seems as though these clothes, like my nightgown, are more comfortable for him for the journey. He is on my left, facing me. He asks me how to do this. I tell him he is simply going to have courage. I'm sorry, there's just no other way. He says he's figured out he can't do it without me. It is very loving. He and I are suddenly on the green squared path a few feet down it. We know Voldemort is coming, and we're going to try to make it through this journey ahead of him. Once we're through the archway, we're safe, if we can do it. It will be hard. We head up the path to the point where the books are floating, about midway. I'm ready to go all the way, but he thinks we should pause at this point and wait for Voldemort to get closer. But I am already pulling down the cheap plastic square ring. Once it reaches the ground around my ankles, the path splits apart and bright light shines up with wind blowing like in a movie from the split or crack. Andy and I hold hands. We are both leaning back from the strain of it, but the feeling is that we will hang on here in this spot until the moment comes to go forward, escaping Voldemort. I have to tell you a quick aside. A few weeks after that dream, I was walking up a pathway at my church, and I looked to my right and realized that the concrete double-squared path there, which I hadn't noticed before, led straight into our memorial garden, through the archway with greenery, with yellow flowers, past the fountain, and into the sign that says, "I am the resurrection and the life." It kind of gave me chills. I've never before or since had such an archetypal dream. This dream is still working on me, still working in me. I reflect on it from time to time as a new phase of my journey has emerged. I don't know that I would have had such a dream if I hadn't been equipped to understand it more. Because even though I still don't understand all of it, the education I've received at this conference has prepared me to carry this treasure. When I had this dream, I was going through a rough period in all aspects of my life. I had just had a baby 8 months before. My husband and I owned the independent bookstore I mentioned that had been a hallmark of Columbia since I was 2 years old. All of this was a big strain on us and our relationship. The book business, as you all must know by now, is crazy. We all know about Walmart and grocery stores selling books, and we know about e-readers, and of course we know about Amazon. What you might not know is that not only is there competition from outsiders, there is competition on the inside. When the hottest commodity of the first decade of the 21st century for bookstores was released in a given year, that would be a new Harry Potter book, the stores themselves fought to see who could lose the most money, battling for market share. 2006, when I had that dream, was the beginning of the end. Andy and I knew this couldn't last. The happy bookseller would not make it indefinitely. Though we knew it inside, it was hard to face. We began brainstorming about other careers. I even started Bob's spiritual direction training program, but couldn't make it work with a baby and a retail business that required long hours of work. I was also sick with celiac disease, though I didn't know it until later that year. When I entered the spiritual direction program, I of course wrote a spiritual autobiography. In that, I included as the closing a dream I'd had before beginning the program. In brief, I dreamed that we were selling the new Harry Potter book, Harry Potter and the Black Knight, Knight with a K. For those of you who aren't entirely familiar with the series, there's not a book by this title. So in 2006, in Waking Life, we were awaiting the release of the final book in the series, Book 7, which would appear in July 2007. In my dream, this Harry Potter and the Black Knight came out straight to paperback and not in the usual hardcover first. In the book world, a book's release straight to paperback likely means the publisher thinks it has a great shot, will have a big audience, but does not warrant a push first in hardcover, which is more costly but also more profitable to a publisher if it sells well. In the dream, we are selling this new Harry Potter title at a 10% discount. My yoga teacher is in the store. She's someone I consider a spiritual guide and spiritually mature person, and she is saying it's not enough, just not enough. 10% just wouldn't compete. Because of my budding knowledge of dream work, and because of what Chelsea Wakefield had taught me about archetypes over 2 summers of head-scratching, it occurred to me to look up the meaning of the knight archetype in Carolyn Mace's work. The knight archetype is primarily associated with chivalry, courtly romance, protection of the princess, and going to battle only for honorable causes. The knight serves his king or lord, and so this archetype has spiritual overtones, as well as those of service and devotion, Loyalty and self-sacrifice are the knight's great virtues, along with a natural ability to get things done. The Black Knight, the shadow side of the knight. The Black Knight donning armor and riding a black horse represents the shadow characteristics of this archetype, especially the absence of honor and chivalry. Somewhat like the warrior, the Shadow Knight manifests its loyalty to a questionable ruler or principle. In its negative aspect, the knight can also, like the rescuer, fall into a pattern of saving others but ignoring his own needs. A true knight, like the mystic, walks the fine line between self-sacrifice and self-neglect. When I looked this up in 2006, the reference I found then but cannot locate now worded it this way. It said the shadow side of the knight represented the defender of futile, not feudal, causes. Wow. The message could not have been more clear. But finding the way out, that was a whole other problem. I guess I was just going to have courage. We couldn't save the other, the bookstore, anymore. In 2008, at the end of the last day the Happy Bookseller was open for business, we closed the doors for the final time. It was Halloween night. How appropriate. I rushed home from the store with my two young sons to get them in costume and out trick-or-treating. I love Halloween. I always have. It's important to be able to go out in danger, take risks with strangers, and laugh at the darkness. Well, I was going to need to laugh because I could not find a job for another 2 months, and I'd been looking and networking like crazy for four while trying to tie things up at the store. It was a black, bleak time that I barely remember at all, those 2 months after we closed the doors. Two children to support and no income is a serious problem. Thank goodness we had decided not to try that bigger house the year before. I wanted to say to Agnes, thank you. I threw the I Ching on that one, and it saved our making a big mistake. The only thing I remember, besides spending endless hours on the computer looking for jobs and knowing that was futile, is praying, really praying. Surely God has more use for me than this. Surely I have more to offer. Please, God, not my will, but yours. I wasn't Jacob. I couldn't get for myself what God had already promised me. I was powerless. I surrendered. Finally, in December, one of the priests at my church put me in touch with Dr. Amy Montanez, a psychotherapist and spiritual director in Colombia. Amy was looking for an office manager. It was only part-time, and I desperately needed full-time, but beggars can't be choosers. And besides, I was so hoping to somehow enter the field of spiritual formation. I couldn't go back to school. I had to rely on my work as the entry point. What a blessing that has been. Amy is phenomenal. She is a fantastic role model. But since I needed more money, I networked with friends in the restaurant business to get a job at a new, hip, fancy Italian restaurant opening that January. I was fired up as Jacob now. I was determined to get a job waiting tables, which I'd never done before, and earn some serious money. I was going to get it for myself, no matter what. I had to. It was my responsibility. Long story, but I didn't get to be a waitress, only a hostess, which was challenging and fun, but earned me almost no money and took me away from the kids 3 nights a week. It was a disaster. In the week before I began work at the restaurant, I dreamed that I am there on opening night. I am a server, and people had filled the restaurant. In fact, there are tables set up for a mile down the walkway of the nice shopping center in which it is located. Some serious outdoor seating. Turns out I am responsible for those tables. The chefs are super backed up, and all of these outdoor tables are full, and no one has food or drink. I go in the restaurant to try to get water for them, at least. A good friend of mine is busily scooping ice. She's a real taskmaster in waking life. She, in her fun-loving style, has a fuzzy stuffed beach ball with her. She had learned goofy restaurant tricks from her grandparents, who owned a famous restaurant in Atlanta in waking life. In the dream, I am unable to get even water for these tables in a timely fashion. I can't get what I need for whatever reason. No one is mad yet, but they've been there a while. The dream ends before anything else happens. As I worked on the dream in the next few days, I saw that it wasn't just an anxiety dream. I saw that God was telling me, "It's okay, Jacob. Just take that beach ball and have fun while you're there. You are not going to be able to serve here. It is a futile effort." 2 months later, my boss, Amy Montanez, helped me make connections with Trinity Episcopal Cathedral. I received a call because they were looking for someone to run their bookstore, which had closed in December of 2008 until further notice. Which brings me back to Bob. Through my pit journey of spiritual formation, theological education, and building community, I had decided that I wanted to work for the church. The meaningful work I would be through it. I didn't know how that was going to happen and was scrambling around looking for administrative jobs that would get me in the door. I am a good administrator, but I'm also a creative INFP. It's kind of a miracle that I'm a good administrator, and I'm not one in entirety. I can't be. That's why working administratively as I do now for a spiritual direction practice in a cathedral bookstore works for me. I'm surrounded by the spiritual journey and theological education in my work. Through the blessings of dream work, and thanks to gathered community here at the conference, a dream group member, who was also a veteran of this conference, first saw this about me when I couldn't see it myself. We were working my dream in dream group the fifth year of the conference. The dream involves a golf course with a pear-shaped sand pit. It is surrounded by pairs of palm trees. Two girls, a blonde and a brunette, are clinging to orange netting, like around a construction site, and gazing longingly through it at the sea, which they cannot access. Nearby, there's an empty building that looks like a McDonald's, but with no signage. It is in a parking lot with newly painted white lines, empty and neat. The dream group participant's comment was that for him, the empty parking lot and store symbolized fear of people shopping somewhere else, and that fast food was not the right kind of nourishment for him, longing for meaning, reflection time, and depth. In his dream, the main character was longing to be away from all these commercial responsibilities, such as changing money, filing invoices, and other administrative duties. But these housekeeping tasks have to be done to survive. As soon as I was offered the job of bookstore director at Trinity, I drove straight to the restaurant and quit, of course offering to work through the week to help out, but I still quit. Now I have two jobs that combine administrative tasks with spiritual ones. The choir master at the cathedral where I work asked me not long ago, "So, what's it like working in the bookstore? Pastoral counseling?" I said, "Yes, it is. How do you know?" But I would still like to go deeper. I'm still in that golf course dream, longing for myself to carve out time for more depth and reflection, and I want to share that, particularly in the church. That's an area in which I feel called. This conference is for people from all faiths and with many different ministries, but Bob Hayden has been a particular inspiration to me because I feel a kinship with his mission of returning the ancient spiritual practice of dream work to the church. On the whole, the return of the contemplative tradition, the sacred feminine, the mind of Christ, to the world. As Larry May said so beautifully 2 years ago during the morning meditation in Canuga's lovely chapel, we, the people here, are invited to help bring back into balance a world that's been so badly out of balance for so long. The church is no exception. It has been so badly out of balance for so long that many are becoming disillusioned with it, feeling they can't say the creeds or profess such a faith. What has been so enriching for me is that Education for Ministry and the Hayden Summer Dream Conference have allowed me to apply meaning retroactively to all that I learned, lived, and experienced growing up in the church. Deep meaning. This has made the church come alive for me. Jesus got this stuff we're talking about here this week. He knew it. He knew the depths of the wisdom tradition. He just couldn't make us know it. And he couldn't stop centuries of human hijacking of the church for political gain. Still, I have found such community and love in the church as to think that there is a holy framework there, that if it could just be filled in by the Holy Spirit, by parishioners' participation in their own journeys, their doing of their own inner work. Though we're nowhere near going deep enough in the church, and though it is a human organization, I believe it can be transformed if we bring back the sacred feminine, the missing half. As Jerry Wright has taught me, Logos and Eros need to be married. I believe the church can be transformed, but it remains to be seen what will happen. Here, in the midst of God's glorious creation at Canoga, we are with a group of people who love deeply and who have a common mission in mind, the mission of doing their part to bring about the restoration of the world and the redemption of creation. Joyce, as I mentioned, I think I'm out of the pit, but I am still seeking my role. The cathedral where I work has been through a time of huge transition since I've been there. And though I weathered some of the trauma poorly, letting it get to me through great anxiety and returning to my Jacobness, I have come out of that through many powerful dreams that have guided me in my growing up through it. Dreams that have sometimes been dually transformational for me and precognitive. I could not have lived life in this transformational way without the community I have made through this conference. Thank you, Bob, with all my heart, and thank you to all of the fantastic presenters and dedicated attendees who return year after year. I love you all very much. Now, I invite you to a decadent week of shopping at the Hayden Grocery Store. Bob, I see a new logo in your future. The offerings here are abundant. Dreamscapes, spirit guides, writing your own book of life, shadow work, Myers-Briggs, color, poetry, quantum science, the hero's journey, myth, and holy scripture, and much, much more. Really, all the ingredients we need to create a meaningful and fulfilling life through our own inner journeys to wholeness. I hope we will go forth from here in the name of unity consciousness to heal the world. And Mom, you're off the hook for the ducky dream. I'd like to ask you all to think about what this conference has meant to you, and those of you who are here for the first time, to be present and think about the opportunities you have here and reflect back on them. How has this conference changed your life? Thank you.